Order of Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee. Members, we have a couple things today. We are going to have House File 3200, Representative Peterson's bill first on early childhood community partnerships. Then we're going to have the Child Care Advisory Task Force recommendations report. We have some folks from the department talking, and then Representative Kulik Jackson will have a bill up after that relating to child care assistance program. With that, welcome to the committee, Representative Peterson, if you'd like to explain your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. You know, this is an exciting bill and one which we worked on for several years. In fact, I presented one that was somewhat similar a few years ago, and I think the idea is so good, I'm back again.
Well, just a second. We have to move the bill.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, okay. Since you're a member of the committee, would you like to move it for possible inclusion?
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 3200 for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Representative Peterson moves that House File 3200 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill.
Okay.
Now, if you'd like to.
Now I can go. Okay, thank you. It's really an important idea, and actually we do have a number of the community partnerships already around the state that have been operating kind of on their own, but this bill would really set up a policy so that all over the state we would have opportunities to establish these community partnerships, and they're really important. We know that the delivery system for families with young children is very fragmented, very disjointed, and uncoordinated, and that communities are often very different in their racial and cultural and language makeup, and communities really do know best what the families and children need to succeed. So these partnerships within the community are very effective, and they allow the communities to build on the strengths to address the distinctive needs of the families and the children in their communities. Early childhood community partnerships help local communities communicate, coordinate, and collaborate to deliver services that families and children need. And the coordinated comprehensive services include family supports, special needs intervention, and health and mental health care, in addition to quality early learning. And I might add that as we've gone around the state and we've listened to providers, these are the kinds of needs that providers are talking to us and saying that some sort of community collaboration would be great. And we did see some of these collaborations in some of the communities, such as Fergus Falls and others, and we'll be talking about that as we progress with our discussion this afternoon. And the partnerships would be held accountable for assessing children's progress and measuring kindergarten readiness. And the funding to support community partnerships allows communities to streamline services, more effectively share and utilize limited resources, and build public awareness of the importance of the early years. And as you've had a chance to look through the bill, you can see that this bill establishes these partnerships through a grant program, and it really talks about specifying that a grant program or one of these community partnerships be established in various parts of the geographic regions of the state. And it encouraged collaboration among the parents, which I think is really important. The program components are on Subdivision 3, and it talks about high-quality early childhood care settings, meaningful kindergarten transition services, and outreach for the developmental screening. And then it also talks about an advisory committee for each of these collaboratives, and then also about the grant awards. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to several testifiers. And first is Karen, who will introduce herself and talk about the program.
Members, also just a reminder, we are on TV today. If you did not know that, or if the testifiers don't know that, we are on live TV. So
didn't know that.
Smile a little.
It would have smiled.
Right. Yes. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Karen Kingsley. I'm the Director of Policy and Civic Engagement at Ready for K. We're a statewide nonprofit organization dedicated to making sure that all Minnesota children arrive at kindergarten ready to succeed. We're really excited today to be here to talk about House File 3200. the Early Childhood Community Partnerships Bill. There are three things that I really want the committee members to remember today about this: family-friendly, outcomes, and integration. Those are the kinds of things that these community partnerships can contribute. I want to say first that this bill is supported by an alliance of early childhood groups from child care, Head Start, School Readiness, ECFE, and we've all come together and we agree that community partnerships is a key strategy that we can use to achieve school readiness in Minnesota. There are states that are leading the efforts around early childhood, like North Carolina and Washington State, have early childhood community partnerships as a key part of their strategy. And it's something that I think makes sense for us to do as well. They're really a way, these community partnerships, to bring together all of the various strategies that we've been talking about: high-quality early learning, access to health care, home visits, outreach to family, friend, and neighbor, quality rating system, professional development. It's a way to bring all of those strategies into one plan and one organized community moving forward in the same direction towards achieving results. The community partnerships bill that you have before you is actually based on successful community partnerships that are already happening in the state. You've heard, this committee has heard from the Invest Early Collaboration in Itasca County. There's also multiple coalitions, more than 80 early childhood coalitions that the Minnesota Initiative Foundations are funding, and you'll hear more from them. There's projects in St. Paul and Minneapolis that are working on this. So this is something that has really already been happening in communities, and they've been funded primarily by private foundations. And what we need now, I think, is a statewide approach that really says, how are we going to make sure that all communities have this opportunity to bring these services together so that we make sure that we reach that goal that you've set about all kids ready for school by 2020. So the legislation really does state that these partnerships are there with the purpose of increasing outcomes. They're focused on school readiness outcomes. They're focused on increasing a number of children who are in high quality. So it's not just we're getting together for the sake of getting together. We're getting together to achieve outcomes. One of the things that we've also seen is that this kind of collaboration really helps us utilize the existing resources more effectively. And the Invest Early collaboration is a prime example of that. Head Start and school programs and child care programs are all at the table. They have a blended classroom where Head Start kids and school readiness kids are in the same classroom. So if there's ever an opening where a child moves out of the district, it is often much easier and faster to fill that spot because, first of all, they have that child often already in the classroom, maybe funded by different sources. So it's less about finding children to fill that classroom spot and more about making sure that we're utilizing the existing public dollars the best. At Invest Early, their community partnership has created a joint application so that when parents are coming in, this is part of the family-friendly aspect of it. They don't have to have a separate application for Head Start or the school-based program. It's one application. They're part of that community partnership, and the children are moved into those services and supports as needed. The actual funding in some of these partnerships goes to helping that collaboration happen and also filling the gaps where there aren't funded services. So access to healthcare might be something. Access to transportation might be something else. So it's a way in which the existing programs and services can be supported to be more effective and more efficient by having that collaboration work together. Another key aspect is the evaluation of these programs. It's a way to make sure that we're really paying attention to what's happening with those children and intervening, because you've got a number of partners at the table who can bring their skills and supports to the situation. So one of the things that's interesting about this bill is that it may have implications for other bills that you'll be hearing. It talks a lot about the importance of health and family supports and early learning being integrated on the community level. It makes me think about Representative Peterson's other bill about an Office of Early Learning and how can we be integrating those services at the state level. So I think to make these community partnerships most effective, we need to be thinking about what else needs to happen at the state level. And I'll just close to say again that we think this is a really important strategy and one that I would encourage you to support.
Thank you. And our next testifier is Jane Patrick, who comes from Fergus Falls, a ways away. And we did visit this particular community this fall and with their providers, and we were so impressed with what they were doing. And so she's here today to talk about their collaborative.
Welcome to the committee. I think we actually have two testifiers. We have an additional one from Fergus Falls, Nancy Jost.
Nancy Jost is here to add anything that we might need at the end.
Okay, great. Well, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, thank you also for allowing us to speak with you today. My name is Jane Patrick. I'm the coordinator for the Fergus Falls Early Childhood Initiative, as well as several other collaboratives and collaborative projects in the West Central Minnesota region. I was very impressed by this bill because it really stands for what we are doing in rural Minnesota. And I could see this being a great stepping stone for many other communities throughout the state of Minnesota. For us in rural Minnesota, it has allowed us to stretch limited funding and resources through collaboration. Basically, we have small agencies with small funding pots, and we're able to combine staff and financial resources with these types of collaborations, allowing us to do a lot more with less. It brings collective wisdom to the same table. We are able to address common challenges and concerns, such as referral processes, assessment tools, strategies, quality care and education issues, and basically it helps achieve consistency for families, and it eliminates the need for agencies to address these challenges individually. It provides an avenue for information and resource sharing, both about individual agency programs and about services, which in the long term reduces the duplication of services across agencies, and it helps to identify gaps as well. So we know where there are services missing, and we know what families need based on the collective table and the knowledge that gathers there. And ultimately, it helps to connect families with more resources, which are already out there. We're not reinventing the wheel, because we have all the players at the table who can identify the resources that the family needs. I'm going to share with you just a few examples of some very successful collaborations that have occurred for us in the West Central Minnesota area. One of them is the Early Childhood Dental Network. As you're all aware, I'm sure there are some huge disparities for oral health and for low-income children. And our Early Childhood Dental Network has brought over 40 individuals together from 9 counties to create unique solutions to the complex problems of access to dental care for low-income children. It also provides a structure for quality, consistent training opportunities for the professionals who work with children and families to access the resources that are already out there. And ultimately, what has happened in our region is that we've been able to implement 10 dental outreach clinics in rural communities throughout Minnesota to allow low-income children to access oral health care. In the end, we have provided over 1,400 dental visits since 2005 to 750 low-income children throughout our region. It's huge. It's making a difference. We have also implemented some interagency home visiting programs. We have staff in our Otter Tail County from Public Health, Head Start, Early Childhood Family Education, and Early Childhood Special Education who work on one common program. They deliver the same service to families in their homes, but they're from multiple sectors. It provides stability for the family. They know what to expect regardless of which agency is delivering it. And it also helps us to pool our resources together so that, a little bit of money from Public Health, a little bit from Head Start, we're all able to chip in and provide one commonality for families. Again, this is a program that has provided over 20,000 home visits in Otter Tail County alone since 2001. And as we all know, there's a significant relationship between within our program because of a research study done by the University of Minnesota that there is a significant relationship between our home visits and the families that participate in early childhood family education and school readiness programs. We have statistically proven that within our programs. We also know that the number of home visits positively impacts participation in programs such as the infant follow-along program, which is where early developmental delays are identified for young children. We know that these families are connecting. We have rates of 70% of the families enrolled in our home visiting programs who are connecting with public health programs and other resource programs in the community. 98% of families in our home visiting program have established a regular reading routine with their infants by the age of 12 months. These are huge factors in school readiness. And we also know that about 95% of the children enrolled in our programs are current with their immunizations and their well-child exams. Again, you know, overall health is a key indicator of school readiness for our young children. And I guess in closing, we have many other examples, and I could probably talk all day for you about the programs that we do have, but one other that I will highlight and stress is the work among our schools and early childhood providers with mental health. It's another key area of concern for our young children and families throughout the community. We have IEIC, which stands for Interagency Early Intervention Committees. These are coalitions of individuals from schools, special education, Head Start, public health, all of those key agencies who sit at the same table, and they share information about children with whom there are concerns, of course, at the family's request and with the family's permission. And they look at ways of helping the families. And the parents of the children who have been helped by these programs there's no way to describe the benefits that they have expressed to us that their families have received from these programs. It's just really hard to describe, but it's working. These collaborations are working, and I believe that this bill would greatly enhance the school readiness for children all across Minnesota.
Thank you for being here today, and I know your representative is here, Representative Nornes from Fergus Falls, and we appreciate you taking the time. I think, you know, something we talk about in the Early Childhood Committee is doing a early ed version of Representative Greiling's Minnesota Miracle Bill, and part of what Ready for K has talked about, and Ms. Kingsley is doing this statewide, so as part of a vision for early ed is to be able to have this maybe sort of on a regional basis. And do you see that? Are most of the MIFs doing this kind of work, or is it, are you familiar with other parts? And maybe that's, Ms. Jost can answer that. And then Representative Greiling.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Nancy Jost from West Central Initiative out of Fergus Falls, and I'm the Early Childhood Coordinator. I coordinate all the early childhood initiatives in our region, which is a 9-county region. And two things that I would like to just mention is that on our coalitions, they are made up of early childhood family ed, school readiness, Head Start, public health, law enforcement, social services, child care resource and referral, parents, just a large array of people from the communities. And we are telling you examples today of what we're doing in our region, but actually it's happening all across rural Minnesota with the Minnesota Initiative Foundations. We have over 80 early childhood initiative coalitions, and those coalitions are kind of self-defined as far as geography. Some of them are school districts, some are whole counties, some are towns. So they self-describe what their coalition region is. Did I answer your question?
You did.
Okay. And then the other thing I just wanted to mention was that besides the Early Childhood Dental Network, we also in our region have a school readiness initiative in which we bring communities together, individual communities, and we do a day-long kind of forum on school readiness. We usually have a speaker, and then each individual community meets in the afternoon and puts together a school readiness plan that they're going to be working on for the coming year. We also have a regional interagency early intervention committee, and we bring the local IEICs together on a regional level to look at how we can work together regionally. We have a regional early childhood mental health initiative, again, working with the local communities on a regional level to see how we can work in individual communities, but also on a regional level. And then the last initiative that we have regionally is our child care initiative, and we've involved businesses, and we're also looking at a model to do child care consultation. So we work in local communities as well as region-wide.
Thank you. I think we have a question from Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if it's a question as much as just a statement. And I really am glad that Early Childhood is working on the vision. When PS Minnesota came forward with their recommendations for the new Minnesota Miracle, of course, they included Early Childhood, but we just have two different committees. And so I think this is the sort of initiative that we should be looking at, because we are trying to have reform as well as vision. And so, you know, I've signed on to a bill to have 10 counties instead of 87, and Representative Marquardt and others are looking at county redesign and government reform. And so to have less entities that are providing early childhood and then working together with the mental health collaboratives and so forth, I think is exactly the way that we should be going. And the one thing that I don't like about the bill, which is part of what PS Minnesota recommended not to do, but what is in the bill, and I realize it's a way to start, but having grants, you know, I just think if there's evidence to show that something works, we should make it available for all kids and not just have the haves and have-nots, you know, which we see in the race to the top, we see in other performances or other initiatives. And I guess I do have a question that Representative Mariani and I have been batting back and forth here, and maybe the testifiers know. What happened to the family service collaboratives? Are they still around, and if so, how do they tie into this and so forth?
Madam Chair and members, I'd be happy to answer that question. And in fact, one of my other hats that I wear in Otter County is as the Family Service Collaborative Coordinator. So I'm very familiar with them, and it ties in beautifully. It is an absolute beautiful marriage. And it is something that I see it as an offshoot of family service collaboratives, and in many instances in our region, it is actually that. It's just an offshoot of their family service collaborative.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. We also have a question from Representative Nornes. Yes.
More or less a comment rather than a question, but first wanted to thank Jane and
Nancy.
Nancy, excuse me for just a moment, for taking the time to come down here and testify and share with us. And pretty proud of what we're doing back there in Fergus Falls. And mm-hmm. I do attend a few of the meetings, but Jane has to be the busiest person around as far as keeping all of this straight. And so I just wanted to say thank you for all the hard work, and we'll see what happens here. Thanks.
Thank you. We also have another person in the audience that wants to testify, Dr. Ephraim. So I will ask her, is she here? I thought I saw her. Oh, there she is. If she can come forward, and then if there's questions, and otherwise we will have closing comments on the bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. My name is Karen Ephraim. I am here on behalf of EdWatch, and I, again, appreciate the concern for young children and families that is represented in this bill, but have a number of concerns. This is a reappearance of a bill that was heard in 2007 or 2008 that engendered concern actually from members on both sides of the aisle regarding expansion of size and scope of government, as well as concerns about family interference with family autonomy and parental authority. There's a big push to expand these types of programs. However, the actual effectiveness of them is basically anecdotal. And if you look at the new study that came out about Head Start, for example, again, which I've discussed, there's no effectiveness and no change in academic performance beyond the first grade. There's a number of studies that show that Head Start, or that, I'm sorry, that home visiting doesn't have a great deal of effectiveness as well. As I've said before, New Jersey, which was court mandated to fund early childhood for the poorest students in its state, actually saw National Assessment of Educational Progress reading scores decline in those students that received that help. Oklahoma and Georgia had actually had declines in their fourth grade reading and math scores. So when we're talking about expanding and doing more programs and spending more money, we need to be looking at true effectiveness and not just feelings of effectiveness. There are also many studies which I've presented to this committee before about not only academic harm but concerns about increase in behavioral and emotional problems in children that are in early childhood programs. Regarding the mental health, even the professionals admit that there is a great deal of difficulty accurately diagnosing young children. This kind of push to expand mental health screening and diagnosis has resulted in a 40-fold increase of the diagnosis of bipolar disorder in children as young as 2 being treated with antipsychotics, and now the American Psychiatric Association in their Diagnostic and Statistical Manual is moving away from using the diagnosis of bipolar disease in children. So there is a huge amount of controversy even in the professional world, and I don't think that we should be expanding that in programs for very young children.
Start to wrap up.
Yes. School readiness is the goal here, but the stronger and more important question is how children perform in school in the long term. And the fourth grade, both National Assessment of Educational Progress and international scores show that children do fine already. And there are also studies showing that the achievement gap will actually be erased when children are in two-parent families and have religious involvement. So kindergarten readiness isn't necessarily the be-all and end-all parameter. And finally, again, I would bring up the issue of cost, government spending, and high deficits at both the state and the federal level. We really don't have the money for this, and putting more burden on state programs is just going to force more parents into the workforce when they would rather stay home and raise their kids to pay for programs that have questionable value. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Peterson, we would like to have closing comments, and then we're going to need to move on to the next agenda item.
Be very brief. Just a response also about the grants versus funding. We would enjoy just having funding for regional centers all around the state, but we realize the fiscal constraints right now of the budget. And so we are anticipating potentially some of these grants could come from the ARRO funding from the federal government, which are, and there are this type of grants included in some of the proposals that went for that national or federal funding. So we'll see. This is good policy, and so we're hoping that's where these would come from.
Hey, Representative Peterson, we have a question, so let me see.
Yes.
That Representative Mack.
Sorry to interrupt. I just thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Peterson. I just had a couple of questions, and I'll kind of stick to one. In Subdivision 5, it talks about the two types of grants that are available, and I'm wondering, are those coupled together? Inherently, an applicant would get, if they apply for one, they get both. That's my first question. Are they completely separated? And then two, on line 3.28, it says there's a 15% increase in the second year of the grant if set outcomes are met. And I'm just wondering, as far as the funding of this and expected costs, are they guaranteed a certain amount of grant dollars and then there's a 15% bump on top of that? Or are they guaranteed 85%? Or how does that funding structure work?
Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to ask Karen, I think, to respond to that because she's done more work on the grant. And believe me, the grant process is a little bit in flux yet because much of it would depend on what happens with the federal application.
Ms. Kingsley, welcome back. If you can state your name and answer the question.
Madam Chair and members, Karen Kingsley with Ready for K. When we were discussing the ideas of this, we know that some communities are ready to implement these kinds of projects. They've got their partners already lined up, as you heard from some of the Minnesota Initiative Foundations. And those communities, we think, would be prime candidates for the implementation grants. There may be some communities that have not come together yet that don't have their partners speaking together, and those communities could apply for a planning grant. And I guess if the funding continued in the future, those who had a planning grant would then be ready for an implementation grant. There isn't a set amount in the legislation at the moment, in part because we don't really know what the resources available are, but one of the things that we know is that these partnerships take time and that the outcomes that people are trying to achieve obviously take time. We know from the Invest Early collaboration that they're starting to see results after 3 years of being in operation. So those implementation grants would hopefully continue in the next year to make sure that collaboration stays and stays effective and helps continue to get the new generation of kids moving along. And the 15% bump was basically to say, we want results, and if you're going to get results, you're going to get rewarded for getting those results.
Representative Mack?
So just a follow-up. If an applicant receives a planning grant, are they inherently, guaranteed or can plan on an implementation grant, or if they have the match and the money for, to put a planning process together, but then are also planning on getting the grant for the implementation, is that guaranteed, or is that something they have to find out down the road after they've put the money in for planning?
Ms. Kingsley?
Madam Chair and Representative Mack, what this bill does is it calls on the Commissioners of Human Services, Education, and Health to work collaboratively on putting out the application. So I would imagine that some of the questions that you're asking would be revealed in that request for proposals when it is available. I think there wasn't any assumption on our part that if you've been able to do the planning with private resources that you wouldn't be eligible for an implementation grant. And I believe that many of us are with Representative Greiling is that we would like this to be something that is available perhaps on a formula basis throughout the state, and that's certainly what other states are doing. So in that case, it would be available everywhere, and there wouldn't have to be a request for a proposal.
Representative Mack.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Peterson, any closing comments
now? Well, just to remind people, this is voluntary. We would hope, as they did up in Grand Rapids, that we'd have foundations that would all, and other businesses that would help contribute to these collaboratives to make them financially feasible. And it does provide the wraparound services that we think are so essential for success with all early childhood. We can give them the great programs, but we also need the health services, we need the home visiting services, we need the whole package, the wraparound package. It reminded me of Jeffrey Canada and his efforts at at doing that, but this just picks out a small group, the early childhood area, and says we're going to do it with these folks and help them to be ready for first grade, kindergarten and first grade. Thank you.
Representative Peterson, would you like to renew your motion?
Okay, I would renew my motion to pass House File 3200 for inclusion, possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 3200 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will have the next testifiers come up on the Child Care Advisory Task Force Recommendations Report, Cherie Katilnik and Don Van Ryan. And after that, we will have Representative Kulik Jackson's bill. In the meantime, I need Representative Hamilton.
Yeah. Oh, Madam Chair, just a comment while they're coming up. I've heard the comment, Dr. Ephraim brought it up, and I've heard it a number of times in this committee, where they talk about the early childhood programs, and then once the children hit first grade, there's no education performance differences or anything like that after the first grade. And I don't know, I was wondering if we could get additional, maybe that's a topic that we can talk about, you know, at some other point in time, but I think it's a topic that we should probably address. And maybe it's something that's in your committee as well. But again, I've heard it from multiple sources in this committee that we can provide all these great services beforehand, and then we funnel them into a system that it seems like there's some questions once they hit the first grade. So,
Representative Hamilton, I think that's a good idea. We do hear more of that. I was on a panel with the elementary school principals organization, and we had several panelists, and one was talking about a great program at Wellstone School in St. Paul, and they had that exact problem where the kids were very ready, and then they went into the K-12 system, and then that they were above where the other kids were already, so they kind of lost some ground. So I think that's something we have to think about. If we're going to gear up our early childhood programs, then the K-12 system has to be ready to receive them. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hamilton. I think you just said what I was going to say, that you can't have these be in isolation, because if you have a great early childhood system, and we did Utopia there, and then you went into huge class sizes and didn't follow research in K-12, then you'd be in big trouble. We have something called, you don't serve on K-12, but we have something called innovation revenue that's in the new Minnesota Miracle, and that's exactly what that's for, is to make sure that districts use a sizable portion of the new money, if we ever get around to it, for evidence-based practices and research-based practices that actually work to make a difference with how kids are growing in their test scores and other measures. And there's plenty of research that shows that low class sizes up through third grade make a huge difference. So if you go from early childhood into large classes, or you didn't have all day kindergarten but you did have all day early childhood, you know, they're just it just wouldn't compute. But if you do have follow research all the way up, then your money in early childhood, which Art Rolnick constantly tells us is very well spent, and you know, if you save $12 for every dollar spent, and if it's at-risk kids, then you save even more. So, but we do have to do not one or the other, but both. So, thank you for that.
Thank you. Representative Blyne,
Chair Slaugher, just to add to some of the comments of Representative Greiling, Head Start has some other programming things that they do with parents and a different approach really than we see in the schools, and it shouldn't be a surprise that if you discontinue some of those things that support families and support kids who have had difficult experiences in the past, that you wouldn't see the same performance as time went on, just because so you know, yes, the K-12 system needs to be aware of there are some needs here that need to be met, and to ignore them is we ignore it at our own peril. So
point. Representative Mariani.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton just sort of got a whole bunch of us going here, but actually I think it's a great question and a great request, and I do note that last year we did spend, Madam Chair did arrange for at least one here and possibly two, where we heard kind of at a, you know, on a macro level the importance of public policy that is informed by objective research, and that there are structured ways in which other governmental units, I think we heard about a model in one of the provinces in Canada, state of Washington has a very, really a much further down the road than I think any other state, in regards to a dynamic that they've set up that informs the legislative body from an objective research-based effort. I actually have a bill, Madam Chair, that attempts to emulate some of that. It's a bill that Senator Rummel and I have been working on. We tried to play that out within the K-12, strictly the K-12 realm, but we've expanded it now to have a discussion to put it within the context of this whole need for us to redesign government so that it can be both more efficient and more effective. And so hopefully that's getting a hearing in another committee. But I would say that probably one thing we could do rather quickly, since, and particularly Head Start, is probably one of the most studied programs of our age. It's been around for several decades. So there are several longitudinal studies that have been done. I think a quick, simple thing we can do is certainly ask our staff here to just put together a quick bibliography of those sources for us, so we can start with that. And then I think structuring an opportunity for us to have a discussion around those studies would be a good use of our time.
Great suggestion. Well, I will ask the staff to, I'm not sure who exactly the staff means. Either the CA or the researcher. We'd appreciate if you want to talk about who would be doing that, but to put together a list of evidence-based practices. And that's something I also am very interested in. We have two more questions, Representative Kulik-Jackson, then Representative Nornes, and then we'll start with our testifiers here. Representative Kulik-Jackson.
Well, Representative Hamilton's great question, got me thinking too. You know, I would certainly love to see a couple of groups to look at, and that would be the Head Start kids who have made gains who go into the smaller class size, more comparable holistic approach in K-12, and those who don't, because I think we'd get a better idea of whether it's academic gains in Head Start, which really just sort of fizzle, or is it the discontinuation when you get into kindergarten, and that'll help us to define it. One other thing is I like looking beyond just the academic, too, because there's certainly a while academics is important, I haven't heard anything to refute the sort of social gains made by the percentage of kids who actually stay in school and graduate and then go on to work and you know, stay off of public assistance and out of the juvenile justice system. That also has a cost to the kids and a big cost to society. And I've heard the thing about the academics too, and that even children who have been pushed reading-wise, I'm a little guilty of that. I noticed by third grade, you know, my kid went from stellar to just a pretty good.
Good. Thank you. And Representative Nornes?
Madam Chair, just a quick comment, and then we can move on. But sometimes I think we study things to death here and probably make very little progress. But I was just going to share that my grandson, who's in fifth grade, doesn't particularly like school. Typical boy. But his teacher has discovered his, soft spot, whatever it is, the incentive that he, when he does well and others in the class, they get a certificate to Taco John's. And that has done amazingly. It's really been the answer.
So there's all kinds of incentives.
And it's very simple. Yes.
Here we go. Well, number of theories today. With that, I also need approval of the minutes. Representative Ward, have you read the minutes?
Madam Chair, I have, and I move approval of the minutes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ward moves approval of the minutes for February 25th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 25th are approved. With that, we'll move on to our testifiers. Welcome to the committee. And I think, Ms. Kotelnik, would you like to start? State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Cherie Kotelnik, and I'm the manager of the Child Care Assistance Programs for the Department of Human Services. And my co-presenter here is Dawn Van Rijn, and she is our program policy specialist for the child care assistance program. And so you've seen a lot of her work in the legislation that gets developed and things like that. And she works with your staff quite a bit. And she was the person who was the lead on the task force that we worked with. So they had good, strong leadership. And I want to point out that my boys, when they were at the age of yours, went for the Pizza Hut bonuses. It didn't work as well with my daughter. Okay, I'm going to try to do justice to all the work that was done by this committee. The committee met 8 times during the time that it was in session. The directive to us to establish this committee was done in 2008, and we had a directive to review the child care assistance laws and policies and make recommendations to remove barriers facing families applying for or receiving child care assistance. So it's a pretty big responsibility. There were 17 members on the committee. They represented all the categories and groups that you advised us to include, which were counties and organizations that administer the child care assistance program, a parent receiving child care assistance, child care providers, child care and anti-poverty advocacy representatives, and then DHS staffed the group. I might also mention that we saw some legislative staff at one or two of the meetings also. And Sarah Benzkoffer was there, and we appreciated her participation also.
Great. There's a list, right, members on the last page of the report?
Page 15 of the report has a list of the members. Some of them are in this room. One of the members, Nancy Jost, just testified on the previous bill for you. So she's been spending a lot of time with us. I also want to point out that the legislation that was passed did not allow us to do any per diem or expenses for the people who participated in the task force. We had broad representation on this task force. We had parents who came without any reimbursement, and we had very well-attended meetings and lively discussions.
We appreciate that because we know, as you know, we're in a deficit here at the state, so we're
right.
Glad
well,
that people
well, the appreciation come. Should go to those the yeah, people members. Who came from the outside and got no pay for it, and so they did a lot of good hard work. You directed us to look at the length of the application forms, the consistency of the application and reauthorization forms statewide, documentation requirements, including frequency of producing documentation, and barriers facing parents with limited English, and length of reauthorization periods. The committee looked at that, among other things. They really took a comprehensive look at everything that they thought needed to be fixed. Offered presentations to the committee members on all the state and federal laws that govern the child care assistance program. There were presentations on limited English proficiency laws and issues. They had presentations on how the MEC Squared project works and how that's supposed to support this, the eligibility and payment system, and on the MEC Squared Pro system, which is the online system that providers can use to submit their bills for the system. So there was a lot of background information provided. They also reviewed a considerable amount of research, and each of the task force members came with an agenda. I mean, they had ideas about things that needed to be fixed in the child care assistance program. So all those things were melded and tried to be organized into something that made sense as we came forward with recommendations. They all agreed that they wanted to increase client access and retention in the program. They wanted to reduce agency administrative workloads and expense, and they wanted to decrease improper payments to the extent possible. So they wanted to keep that focus.
Ms. Katulnik, are you following the PowerPoint?
I believe that I'm on task force members and process right now, which is slide 5, is probably page
4.
Three.
Okay, so members, there is a PowerPoint,
yeah.
So if you want
and
to follow along.
And I am loosely following the PowerPoint because there's a lot of detail in the PowerPoint that we don't have time to talk with you about today. So I'm going to loosely follow the PowerPoint in the presentation and hope that you ask questions after the presentation for the details that you want to know more about.
Great. Thank you.
As we all know, in recent years, the child care assistance program has been compressed a little bit, and the policies have become more focused on reducing expenditures and aligning to support the work of the parents and the lowest income families. And there's been less focus on continuity of care for children or access to quality. The task force members that came together felt that they really wanted to have some principles that improved that situation for children. And they felt that the CCAP eligibility should follow a child rather than the parent. It should encourage continuity of care for children and that services should be easily available and accessible to applicants and participants in convenient locations and at reasonable times. The intent of this was to improve family outcomes, so not just to pay money for a service, but to improve family outcomes with the service by stabilizing employment and supporting better child outcomes. You will also note the task force recommendations are, we tried to organize them under four different themes. One is funding, one is increased flexibility, one is simplification and consistency across programs, and another is customer focus. You will also note that in most cases, the task force recommendations have financial implications. I mean, some changes were made in the program that made the cost of the program less than it would have been otherwise, and in the process, some things became administratively burdensome. And so changing those to be less administratively burdensome, it's likely that they would have a cost. We also have recently implemented the MEC Squared system, which is the statewide automated system that supports the child care program. And so in some cases, while there might not be a policy cost for a particular change in the program, if it has to be supported by the system and the system has to change, there might be a system change cost to make that work. So I just want you to know that very little in here is free, but we can work on a lot of it. I also wanted to point out that many of the recommendations overlap. If one was implemented, another one might not have to be. So they were looked at separately, but it wasn't all pulled together as a systemic change proposal where everything needed to be implemented in order for it to work. The first category of funding has six recommendations. The first recommendation is related to basically making enough funding available to serve all eligible families. As you know, the MFIP child care portion of the basic sliding, or of the child care assistance program is forecasted, and all families who are eligible to receive child care assistance under MFIP child care can get child care. There's funds available for all those families. The basic sliding fee program has a capped allocation. There are more families eligible than there are funds available, and so we talk a lot about waiting lists. The committee recommended that it be fully funded for whatever eligibility parameters are set. In the event that that doesn't happen, they recommend that if there's unspent funds in the appropriation, that they be put back into the program and not used for some other purpose. That is what is what's the current rule and law say to do, but the legislature in recent years has redirected it to other purposes before it's gone back into the program. Now we're getting into more expensive stuff. The task force recommends increasing minimum provider reimbursement rate to at least the 75th percentile of the current market rate. If you fully funded and were at the 75th percentile, it certainly would cost more than fully funding at the percentile that you're at right now.
And what is that, Ms. Katulnik?
It's
around 35 or?
I believe it's 38.
38, okay.
33?
33.
Okay. 33.
Thank you. Thank you. Thought we'd put that in there. Thank you.
On the next slide, slide 10 I have, which is probably page 5, the task force recommends increasing CCAP eligibility to 75% of Minnesota's state median income. Right now, our entry level is at 47% of the state median income, and the current maximum eligibility is 67% of the state median income. So if entry and exit were changed to 75% of the state median income, it would be a potential change in cost for the program. Things like that could be done, but if you did it within a capped allocation, you would have more families on your waiting list and less people that you could provide service to. They recommend, in the absence of full funding again, the task force recommends changing the basic sliding fee waiting list priority order so families without access to child care assistance can access the child care assistance. Basically what they're saying is that there's a priority on the waiting list for putting families onto the program. The first priority is families without a high school diploma or a GED. The second priority is families who are currently receiving transition year extension services. So transition year is forecasted for 1 year. When families are in a county where there is a waiting list for a basic sliding fee, the forecast continues to support those families until they can get on to basic sliding fee. What the committee is recommending is that the transition year extension continue longer, and that families who are coming off the street, low-income families, be accepted onto the program before transition year extension families. So it's extending the forecast somewhat. And then another piece that's really important to note, because I think it relates to a lot of the other recommendations that are further down, the task force recommends ensuring that administering agencies have sufficient funds to administer the child care assistance program. In 1997, we came up with a calculation that determined that about 10% of the direct service expenditures needed to be used to support the administrative costs at the county level. And the state then reimbursed 5% of that cost and expected that the counties would be covering the rest of the cost. Over time, the cases have become more low-income, high-risk families. They're less stable families, and they require more case intervention. And county budgets have been cut considerably. And what we're finding in a number of cases is that, you know, part of the problem we're having with the waiting list, part of the problem we're having with processing redeterminations, re-eligibilities, is that the counties don't have enough staff to do it, or they're not being able to manage it within current resources. So that's what one of these recommendations is about. Beginning with the increased flexibility, slide 11, so I think it's page six for you. You're testing my math skills now.
Yeah.
there are 8 recommendations related to increased flexibility. Some of these we can work on without legislative change. Some of these we're testing in the School Readiness Connections program already, and you'll hear about the evaluation of that on Thursday. And I will go through some of these with you. Basically, for increased flexibility, they want to improve access and retention of child care assistance for families. They want to prevent breaks in eligibility for services for families. And they want to reduce the administering agency's workload. So those are the kind of things that they're looking for under the increased flexibility recommendations. The first two, A and B, are related to the eligibility authorization time periods, the redetermination periods, and changes that need to be reported. And basically, the first one is saying that they don't want the agencies to have to act on all changes that might affect that might currently affect a family's eligibility. And the devil is in the details on that one. There are some that would make a bigger difference financially than others if that were happening. And also, I mean, it complicates administration to have to act on some things and not on others. So there's devil in the details on that one. And then the other recommendation is related to after the initial authorization, the amount of child care assistance would not decrease for 6 months, except in specific situations. So again, that's a change from current policy. Right now, if there's a change in your eligibility factors, and that means that you're eligible for less care, we reduce the care before the redetermination period. That makes a change in the authorization. That makes it hard for the provider to predict how much time the child will be with them. It makes it, and some of these families change jobs or change shifts or change hours pretty regularly. So it certainly would simplify things, but it would cost money to do it. The next two recommendations, and I might ask Dawn to help me if I'm getting these confused with the two before this, but limiting the situations where administering agencies are required to act on reported information if a family experiences a break in eligibility. Basically, again, this is the less stable families, can there be less conditions in that you have to make a change in their eligibility? And this is particularly directed to things like if there's a temporary income increase, if there's a job change, if there's a school break, if there's a short work shutdown, things that are likely to happen in these families' lives. Are there ways to bridge those for that piece? And then the next recommendation under this one is if there are more stable families that are likely to be in their authorized activity for a longer period of time, Can we do the redetermination after 12 months rather than after 6 months? Both of these would still include making some, recognizing some changes that are reported within the time period, but they would make other changes. So. The next one, under increased flexibility, is related to teen parents in school-based child care programs, and I believe there's a piece of legislation that's coming forward on this one. And homeless clients and other populations with many risk factors. And they're recommending more flexibility in eligibility determination. They're recommending more flexibility in teen parent authorizations, when they're connected to school-based programs, and minimizing documentation requirements.
And yes, we will be hearing about that as Rep. Kulik-Jackson's bill. We'll hear about that shortly.
The next slide, slide 15, which is page 8.
Yeah.
All right, I'll go back to school, is related to self-employed families. And our self-employed families are probably the most complicated families on the child care assistance program. Most of them are starting in self-employment. They're trying to build a career in that area. We have been pretty tightly connected to, you have to make, you have, the amount of money you make divided by the minimum wage is the number of hours that we'll authorize for care. Sometimes when you're starting self-employment, you're working a lot more hours than you could ever make minimum wage for in order to get your business started. We use the income from the tax returns, if we can, to judge the minimum wage income. That includes depreciation and stuff. It doesn't accurately, in some people's opinion, accurately reflect the funds available to the family, and so they think maybe a higher amount of money should be used for the calculation. And sometimes they don't work 20 hours a week. Sometimes it's less if they can't get enough appointments or something like that. So, and we have a minimum 20 hour a week requirement that needs to be met in order to get child care assistance for employment in the child care assistance program. So the recommending changes for self-employed families, all of those would have a cost. And the next category is simplification and consistency across programs. This is the area where we feel like, as an agency, we can look internally in our everyday business and try to do a better job on some of these things. And so we're already, you know, stepping up to start some of these things, changing applications and redetermination forms and things like that. There's 7 recommendations in this category. Some of these things also would require legislation to change. So if it's a recommendation that people want to act on, we want to talk with you about it, and we'll advise on whether we can change it or whether we have to have legislation to do it.
We have about 5 more minutes, and what we might want to do at another point is if you can, or if you're going to tell us now, but I may come back to you about which ones require legislation and talk more about that. So, but if you can try to finish in about 5 minutes.
Okay, well, why don't I let you read the simplification and consistency across program ones, and I won't read them to you, and tell you that there's one other category called customer focus. This is the one that is the one that I feel is most related to the administrative challenges that counties are facing right now. And some of the recommendations under customer focus the first one is waiting list. Basically make waiting list, manage it on a statewide level, and let people, if they move between counties, keep their date on the waiting list so that they don't have to keep trying to manage that themselves. Another one is automating the whole process so that people can apply online and they can look at what's happening to their case online, and they can look to see whether their payments have been made online, and providers can bill online and everything like that. That's a substantial investment in order to bring it to that level of automation. The next one is errors are made in case management. And right now in the child care assistance program, it doesn't really matter whether the agency made the error or the client made the error. If there's an overpayment, the client has to repay it. The task force is recommending that if it's an agency error, that the client not have to repay that money. The way the federal law is currently written, we would have to still recover that money. It probably would have to come from the county agency if that happened. They're also recommending that there be improved collaboration in areas like, shared resources and knowledge and interpretive services across counties. The agency, the Department of Human Services is consulting with agencies across the state about ways to do more integrated services across counties in Minnesota, so that we're referring this recommendation to that subgroup who's working on those pieces.
Representative Downey, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. If I could, I know we're under a deadline here. Do any of these recommendations somehow get us outside of federal requirements, or could we do all of these within the guidelines as they currently exist?
Ms. Kotelnik?
These are fairly loosely described here. There are ways that you could do them that would be out of compliance, and there are ways that you could do them that could be in compliance. We would certainly work with you to do them in ways that are in compliance if you wanted to do them.
Representative Downey?
Thank you. Quick follow-up. And most of them seem to be kind of eligibility or process changes. Did you explore maybe broader model changes or approach differences? I know one idea was to have the money follow the child instead of the parents. Were there other things that looked at credits or other mechanisms to deliver the funding as compared to the existing mechanisms? How kind of how big a whiteboard did you have as you were approaching this?
Ms. Kotelnik?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, people were looking at tweaking the child care assistance program when they were looking at this task force. So I don't think that people stepped back and said, well, okay, if I had this amount of money and I could reshape the program any way I wanted to, what would I have it look like? But I'm glad you brought that up, because I did want to talk for just a second about the next steps in the agency. And, you know, we are reviewing these recommendations and integrating them whenever possible, wherever we can possibly do that within our normal business practices. So we're really trying to do everything that we can that doesn't require legislation. But we're also reviewing the results of these recommendations alongside a current process that's going on, which is the error report process. It's a something that has to happen once every 3 years, where we look at the a sample of cases across the state and look at the administrative practices of the local agencies and calculate the number of errors and in what areas and what the results of these errors are in each of the cases. Every state is required to do this once every 3 years. It's a federal process. It results in a national error rate. And we have built our process in a way that helps us to identify administrative practices that we have that may or may not result in payment errors. They might just be administrative errors that are happening consistently and that align with the recommendations for change here, because we can lose federal money if we don't spend it properly. And so we don't want to have errors in our administration. And if there's administrative simplification, things that work for families and that reduce the errors that might cause us to lose federal money, we certainly want to align those. So we're looking at those two processes. The results of that error report process will be available in June of this year, and we're going to be aligning with that. You'll be hearing on Thursday about the school readiness connections evaluation. Some of the recommendations from this administrative simplification group have already been incorporated into the school readiness connections project. And so, and we've tested some of them out, and we've tested out the cost of them, and and the outcomes for families. And so, on Thursday, we'll be talking to you about the school readiness connections evaluation. We'll be looking at those results as we think about, can we do this whole system in a better way? Is system design warranted and justified? The other large piece of work that we've been working on in the recent last couple years is the market rate survey research, and Representative Slawick was heavily involved in that. We have done the market rate survey this year based on the recommendations of the research group, and now we are analyzing the data based on those recommendations also. I believe this spring, for the first time, we will publish the results of the market rate survey at the 75th percentile based on the new methodology on our website, so that we'll have that. The goal of our work in this area is to, even if we're aligning at the 33rd percentile of the market rate, to get back to the market rate so that it makes sense for purchasing in local communities. Right now we're so distanced from that that there isn't much that we're doing with rates that aligns with the market.
I would like, Ms. Kotelnik, if you could make sure the committee gets a copy of the error report, or at least that I do, that we could disseminate in a, maybe an executive summary or something that we actually can interpret. But it would be, I think, for the committee members, that might be interesting for us to see that. Anything else, Representative Downey? Representative Mariani, and then we'll need to move on to Rep. Kulik-Jackson's bill.
Well, Madam Chair, I think part of my question was wrapped up in Representative Downey's question. I was looking back at the principles here, and it's easier for me to follow the principles of continuity of child care and the accessibility of services. I'm still struggling a little bit around an eligibility framework that says it should follow a child rather than the parent. I think that's in here, but I'm kind of having a hard time separating out, you know, references to parental situations and particularly income situations versus the child. We had this discussion in Legislative Commission on poverty 2 years ago and explored the concept of a system that was really tied to the interests of the child first and foremost. And so this is probably a longer answer, but maybe just a very quick response, and you and I can follow up afterwards.
I can give you a quick response. Basically, the Child Care and Development Fund funding, the federal funding for our program, is designed to support parents in work activities. And so it has to follow a parent who is participating in some authorized activity. Some states are more liberal in their authorization policies than we are. We have been pretty tight on those in order to stretch the money that we have as far as we can to as many families as possible so that they can go to work. That's one of the pieces that's resulting in stopping authorizations if a person is laid off or sent home for a day, and then starting it up again if they find another job, and those pieces that are making breaks and continuities for kids. The School Readiness Connections Project is our first attempt at trying to support the parents' work schedule and also consider the continuity of care for the child in a way that meets the federal regulations. It's getting a lot of national attention because it's breaking new ground by complying with federal requirements and still considering the children and the parents in the model. So we can have longer discussions, yeah. But that's the short answer.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today. And I think members may have more questions. They may be contacting you and as we digest the report and look at the recommendations. So thank you. I'd like to ask Representative Kulik-Jackson to come up. While she's coming up, Representative Mariani, I know you were the chair of the Poverty Commission. And you think about the policies here and the policies around kids, and it's hard if they should be, you know, sometimes when we're trying to save money or we have sort of punitive measures in place, but it does affect especially little kids in a detrimental way. And so trying to keep them child-focused is a good goal, but I think pretty hard in practice. So there is a longer conversation there.
Well, Madam Chair, while we're getting ready for the next bill, one of the things I think that our commission recognized is the need to break cycles. And without a doubt, you know, I think across the aisle and across the entire commission, we felt that being able to pay very close attention to early childhood development and K-12 education is the single most important thing we can do in terms of breaking those deep poverty cycles. And I've had this conversation with the governor. I know that he believes that as well. We have different approaches on how to do that, but there is this sort of strong sense that this is exactly the area where we need to modernize our policies as well as make important investments that are going to pay off down the line.
Good. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. We have about 10 minutes left. We're at the end of our committee time.
I will be very mindful of getting everybody out of here, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'll start out by moving House File 3220 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill.
Representative Kulik-Jackson moves that House File 3220 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill, and we will now let you present your bill.
Thank you. With me today is Mary Sigurdson from Annapolis Public Schools. The District Teenage Pregnancy and Parenting Coordinator. And I'll give you what pleases me most about the bill is those who of us who have ever dealt with bureaucracy and felt that it was a little more form over substance, I think would be pleased by the cornerstone part of this bill, which matches up child care program eligibility for teen parents who are in school to the teen parents' school year. And it makes more sense rather than having them at some point, just because 6 months are up, become ineligible, redo this whole thing to end up the school year. And there are ways that we can fix it so that bureaucracy, you know, the form of it really matches the needs and even simplify. But I will let Ms. Sigurdsson tell us more about the bill and also the repercussions of what happens financially to the school district, because there's a real price to pay when we have snafus.
Thanks. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mary Pat Sigurdsson. I'm the District Teenage Pregnancy and Parenting Coordinator for Minneapolis Public Schools. I think everybody would support having teen parents enrolled in school and their children in high quality child care. Research indicates that when a teen parent is enrolled in a school-based program that provides a number of different things like high academic rigor, support services, and on-site child care and parent education, that it provides positive outcomes for both the teen parent and for their child. In Minnesota, the repeat pregnancy rate for students that are engaged or not engaged in a school-based program is around 27%. For teens that are enrolled in a Minneapolis program that provides on-site child care as well as pregnancy prevention, it's about 8% for repeat pregnancy. Passing this legislation that would provide assumed eligibility as well as extend the period of redetermination up to the school year would really provide a cost savings to the state, because it would both increase the graduation rates for teen parents as well as school readiness for their children. When the state implemented the MEC squared child care assistance authorization program, it artificially removed many young mothers and their children from child care assistance due to documentation and eligibility. The economic viability for child care programs that are linked to school-based services is really key. When we're not able to bill for services that are rendered, our programs are at risk. Right now in Minneapolis, we have provided about $130,000 worth of services that will not be able to be reimbursed because of these sort of bureaucratic snafus that have happened that we just spoke about. Lots of times kids are authorized, and then during the redetermination process, when they need to send in all the other documentation and birth certificates, IDs, proof of where they're living, they're kicked off of the system. That poses a real challenge for school-based programs. We don't want to kick kids out of school, and we would not kick their children out of childcare. So we choose to keep kids enrolled in school and keep them enrolled in childcare, but we don't receive reimbursement for those services. It's also important to note that most of these teens receive TANF. And TANF, the students are obliged to be enrolled in school in order to receive their cash grant. Most child care providers would ask a student if they could provide authorization before they enroll their child in child care. School-based programs don't do that. We bring the children in and we bring the moms in. Once we find that they're ineligible, possibly because of redetermination, often because of redetermination, we don't kick the mom out of school and we don't kick the child out of child care. We keep them in school, but again, we're not able to bill for services that we're currently rendering. Many teens that are on TANF and are unable to get authorization for their child care literally get good cause, which means you have a teen parent that is obliged to go to school or obligated to go to school in order to get their funding. When they can't find child care because there isn't a center that's willing to take them because they haven't been authorized, the student gets good cause, meaning that she can stay at home, retain her cash grant. Her child is not enrolled in high-quality care, and she's still able to get a cash grant, which means that she's likely to extend beyond age 20, enter the adult MFIP system without a high school diploma, and probably her likelihood of remaining on assistance for her lifetime and her child not receiving good quality care and entering school entering kindergarten in readiness is very much reduced. Child care trends have found that almost one half of teen parents are unable to receive their high school diploma or GED by the age of age 20, compared to 89% of young women who remain in school and do not have child during their teen years. Extending eligibility for these kids, allowing the child care providers to be able to collect reimbursement on services provided would keep kids in school, would keep kids in high quality care, and would save the state money in the long run.
Representative Kulik-Jackson, it seems like a very good bill. Do you want any closing comments? Are there any questions, members?
Oh, just that. I think it's a wonderful bill, and when we talk about graduation rates, you know, the last statistic I heard number was that there's a difference in average income of $7,000 a year between someone with that diploma or GED and not. And so to be able to get these kids through high school is going to be a good thing for them and a good thing for the state of Minnesota.
I have a question. To the testifier, are there parenting classes involved as well for the teen parents?
There are. When we talk about this bill, we talk about school-based services. So these are services that provide that wraparound type of education. So they have high rigor academics, they have parenting on site, they have their child care on site, as well in many cases as vocational and kind of linking programs that would help them not have to remain on MFIP their entire life. So that's part of that wraparound service, and that's extremely expensive. And the only way that we're able to provide that is by that fee for service under reimbursement. But when we can't bill for services that we've rendered, we can't provide either the parent education or the child care that's on site. And those are key.
Right. It seems like it makes a lot of sense for teen parents, especially all parents, to have some classes on how to be good parents, as well as they're going to school. I mean, they're juggling a lot at a very young age.
I think the thing to remember is that these are children that we're talking about. They're often highly mobile. These are families that really come from deep poverty. They often have a really hard time just with organization keeping their documentation. So what it seems really easy in terms of just having birth certificates or IDs, those things can really place a burden on families that are very, very fractured by poverty and just by the circumstances of living from place to place, often don't have access to documentation that they need.
Representative Kulik-Jackson, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I renew my motion that House File 3220 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for bringing your bill here today. And members, Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, just a quick question. I apologize if this has already been stated, but are we expecting any other recommendations to come forward out of the task force's recommendations at this point?
Yeah. Well, good question, Representative Mariani. I think that's our main one that has come out. Or they will ask the staff. Our committee administrator, Sarah Benzkofer, says that because of cost, everything else pretty much in the recommendations has a cost associated with it. And because we're in such a big deficit this year, this, I think, is the main one that made the most sense. But I hope all of you will look at the report. I think for me, I mean, it looks like there's a lot there we could be recommending, and there's a lot of improvements to be made. So I welcome you to.
Madam Chair, you had asked, you know, earlier, we just ran out of time in terms of identifying areas that require legislative action. It seems to me perhaps some of those areas might be able to be forwarded with administrative action on the part of the department. And so I'll follow up with them to find that out.
Thank you very much. I'd be interested as well. Members, with that, the meeting is adjourned.